You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Rule number one, don't open the door.
Wow, how did they film that? What is going on?
I think that was one of the best scenes I've seen in a lot of movies.
When you're watching them, you're like, what am I watching?
I don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, no, you love me. You know you love me.
This is like art, dude. This is like right in your face incredible.
I can't stop watching it. What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I mean, I fell in love with it from the opening credits.
It just kind of blew my mind how brilliant it was.
We just know. We can tell. We've watched so many VHS movies.
Yeah, we are sad, sad people.
Hello, hello, and welcome out there in podcast and YouTube land. We are so excited that you have stumbled, fallen, or somehow found Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast where two guys sit around. They talk about horror and science fiction, films, television, literature, key influences, hence the key title, on that particular topic, and things that that topic then influenced our key references to. We've been doing this for a while now. We're glad you stumbled upon us. If you're new, we'd love to have you let us know how you found us. Give us a comment down below, ring the bell, you know, join, subscribe, do all that kind of stuff that everyone always asks you about. If you're returning, yay, great. Glad to have you back with us and hope you'll enjoy this week's little offering, which is kind of unique and different and fun. My name is David. I'm here with my co-conspirator, Tim. Tim, how's it been going? What have you been doing in genre horror this week?
I was going to say I've been doing fine.
Yeah.
And in my genre week, I've been trying to catch up here lately on some newer movies that I missed when they came out. And when I say newer movies, I'm talking like 5 years in the last 5 years.
Okay. That aren't on Shudder.
Yeah, right. And we recently talked about the movie Nope. And shortly before that, I actually visited Jordan Peele's second movie, Us,
mm-hmm.
which was, well, it was in between Get Out and Nope. As far as his directing, I mean, he did Candyman. I think he produced it, and he did The Twilight Zone, which has since been canceled, and I haven't even seen that yet. But anyway, this was his second directorial movie, and I have to say, I like this movie better than Nope.
I watched the first hour of it on a plane and have never finished it. And I need to. I realize that because I remember we were talking a few weeks ago and I remember saying, yeah, I saw Us. And you were going, you saw Us? I said, yeah, I saw Us. But no, I hadn't. I'd seen the first hour. And then
I was going to say another time I talked to you about it, you said you hadn't seen it. So I was kind of confused as to whether you had or not.
Right. So no, I have not officially seen it because I haven't finished it.
So. Okay. Well, as most people know, it's about like evil doppelgangers. That's kind of teased in the actual trailer, so I'm not really giving anything away there. It is written by Jordan Peele as well. I have talked about recent movies that have similar endings, like the movie 1BR and The Invitation, where you find out that you think it's a small movie, but it's actually much larger than you think. Mm-hmm. This movie is very similar. It stars Lupita Nyong'o, who I love. I went on a kick of hers because I watched Little Monsters here lately, too. And I watched Wakanda Forever. It stars Winston Duke, who is also in Wakanda Forever. And it stars one of our favorites, Elizabeth Moss.
Oh, yes. Brilliant.
Who is just a brilliant pop modern actress, I guess you would say, or modern actor. The synopsis is Adelaide Wilson returns to the beachfront home where she grew up as a child. She's haunted by a traumatic experience from her past, grows increasingly concerned that something bad is going to happen. Her worst fears soon become a reality when four masked strangers descend upon her house, forcing her family into a fight for survival. I will say that is the nexus of the plot, but it is much bigger. And those four survivors are quite unique. I mean, the four invaders are quite unique in the fact that they are basically doppelgangers. It scores 93%. On Rotten Tomatoes. I cannot remember what Nope scored, but I'm fairly certain they rank these movies the way I do. Get Out, number one, Us, number two, and Nope, number three.
So he's getting weaker as he goes.
I guess, maybe. But I enjoyed it. It's on, I caught it on Hulu, so you guys may be able to see it on Hulu out there. But that's what I did in my honor week.
Yeah, I've got to finish it because I was intrigued, but I was watching it on a plane too, which I never really like to do because it's, you know, tiny screen, doesn't work for me kind of thing. But so I'll have to finish it and give you my opinion. But I do like Jordan Peele and what he's done. I think I liked Nope better than you did. So
I liked Nope.
It's okay. It's not great, but it's okay. It's good.
I mean, it's kind of like Close Encounters. I like Close Encounters, but maybe it's just that type of movie that just, okay. And it's cinematic, but it doesn't.
Oh, I would not compare Nope to Close Encounters. I would compare it to Signs.
I like Signs, but it's a little more horror oriented to me.
Oh yeah. Much scarier.
And there's creatures and weird shit going on, but I don't know.
Well, interesting. That's a good segue to my, what was I doing this genre week? Creatures and weird shit going on, because months and months ago on our little teaser show we have coming to get you, I mentioned I was excited or intrigued because I saw this teaser trailer for a movie called 65. And it supposedly was from the writers of A Quiet Place, which is a great movie. I really like it. Stars Adam Driver. And basically by starring Adam Driver, it means starring Adam Driver. Like he's other than the little girl character, and he's the only character in the movie. The entire film is him. And Adam Driver is a competent, strong actor. I did not like the character of Kylo Ren, so it was kind of, that's not a good way to judge him, I think. But I loved him in the movie with the divorce movie with Scarlett Johansson was so good. I can't remember the name of it right now, but it's a Marriage Story was the name of it. And it was brilliant. And he's great in it. Not so good in this. This movie is actually, I wrote in my notes, this movie is actually horrible. Why did they make this movie? That's how bad this movie is.
We described it as Jurassic Park meets Planet of the Apes or something.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And that's exactly what it is. Except they give away the whole gimmick thing in the prelude, which, like, when the title sequence starts, it says 65. And then suddenly it slides over and goes million years ago. And you go, why did you just give that away? Why didn't you just let us happen?
But is there a twist where it's really the future and the planet Earth in the future?
No.
Okay, because to me that would be kind of cool to think, oh wow, we're gone now and the dinosaurs are back.
Well, I think what would have been really cool is because it starts out on the spaceship, he's a pilot, he is transferring a bunch of cryogen people to a colony world, and he ends up getting awoken by an asteroid storm that was uncharted. Ship gets damaged by an asteroid strike. He has to find the nearest planet, crashes on it, thinks he's the only survivor for like the good 15 or 20 minutes of the movie, and then suddenly finds a pod that survived. And it's got a little girl in it. She doesn't speak his language. He doesn't speak her language. He's speaking English. But so, and they don't know each other. So it's all about their survival. And it's not until about, and there's strange creatures and weird things. And then about half an hour into the movie, we see the T-Rex for the first time and realize, oh, okay. And see, that would have been a great, oh my God moment, like the Statue of Liberty, they're on Earth sort of thing, because it was so futuristic and now it's not. It's primal kind of thing. But this movie is horrible. It is so badly paced. It is so badly written. The whole last third of it is they've got to get the escape ship. They've got to find it because there was an escape, you know, a shuttle kind of thing that was part of the ship. And it's crashed on, you know, 15 kilometers away on the top of a mountain or whatever. They've got to find it in order to get back into orbit to signal for a rescue ship. And that's going to be the quest, which is fine for a good two-thirds of the movie. But then suddenly the last third, they start seeing comets coming in and meteorites, and you realize that this is right before the big dinosaur strike, the big meteorite is coming and it's going to wipe out life on Earth. So they've got to get
crater.
Yeah.
We're going to get hit by meteors.
I would not recommend this movie in any way for anything. CGI, design, lighting, nothing. It is so weak and so bad.
How does he get there? And isn't there futuristic things there?
No. No, there's nothing.
So how does he get there?
He crashes there on the ship.
Oh, that's right. Okay. So he's got some advanced technology with the ship.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought. I knew I'd seen something that looked a little sci-fi for prehistoric.
Yeah, it's very sci-fi. That's why I said it's very sci-fi to begin with, and then suddenly you throw it into prehistory would have been cool. But they announced it at the very beginning, 65 million years ago on the planet Earth. And then it shows him on his spaceship flying. And you're going, why did you just do that in the title? Does some producer...
Yeah, that's stupid.
Does some producer say you had to do that or people would be confused by your title or something? I don't know. Different title would have helped too, maybe?
Yeah. And I had hopes too because I like A Quiet Place a lot.
I like A Quiet Place a lot. Great story. Cool. I haven't seen the second one yet, but good story.
It's
and
good
well-directed. Too. But this one, he's trying, but... So things just don't add up. Plot points don't work. I got the feeling there must have been a lot of behind-the-scenes struggle in the production of it. And things that, let's cut that scene, let's add this kind of thing. Because some of the cutting doesn't work either. He's really, really injured and this impaled on his side and has to bandage himself up. Da, da, da. Yet in the next scene, he's running like 4 miles to save her from something else. And then 2 scenes later, he's bleeding again. You're going, okay, were those out of sequence? I don't understand. Anyway, it's just not a movie I would recommend.
It sounds like it.
It was not scary. It was not frightening. It was not interesting. It was not sci-fi. It did nothing. So, although those are pretty good segues to where we're going with, with exciting and... scary and sci-fi.
Wow, where are we going? Well, we're going, actually, this is kind of a pioneer effort because it's a first.
Yeah.
We are going back to 1959 with a little movie called The Tingler.
The Tingler, yes.
This is our first venture into the land of William Castle.
Really? Yeah, it is.
I know. You're like me. I had to go back and look at our list from the past seasons because we've done so many now that it kind of blows my mind that we've not hit something of his.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But he's kind of a precursor to Roger Corman, so maybe we're thinking of Roger Corman being a schlock producer.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I was trying to think, is there anything that we haven't done anything even close to Castle?
No, I actually put some movies that we know of in his name on my thing. He did House on Haunted Hill. We've not done that. It's on the list.
Yeah.
13 Ghosts.
Yep.
The one that you like, Mr. Sardonicus.
Yep.
Another one that you like, I Saw What You Did.
Yes.
You've mentioned that a few times on here.
Yeah.
And one that I like called The Nightwalker.
Mm-hmm.
With Barbara Stanwyck, but he also produced Rosemary's Baby. So that is the one thing where we've said this is a William Castle film because it seems so odd that he produced such a big hit.
and that could have been from a financial standpoint, obviously, rather than because that's definitely a Polanski movie.
Well, he was obsessed with getting the rights when he saw the novel or read the novel by Ira Levin, and that's how he ended up somehow getting the rights to do Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
While we're on Castle, I'll say that except for the... I had not seen this movie before, by the way. Sorry, I had not.
I had not either.
But I will say that except for probably the last like 10, 12 minutes, it's very well directed. It's extremely well directed, I think. Just well paced. I like his lighting choices. I mean, it's very... one of my keys is it's very Twilight Zone sort of feel to it. You know, it feels like a Twilight Zone episode kind of extended. But I enjoyed this movie.
Well, one of my notes that I just read in large capital letters says, this is science fiction. So no wonder you like
it. Yes, it is. It's not a... But I do think his horror elements are kind of unique and interesting. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's got a couple of good jump scares, I thought.
Okay, I'll let you tell me about those when we get to it. It actually scores 78% on Rotten Tomatoes, so you're not alone in thinking that it's pretty decent. I'm just going to read this synopsis because I don't know how to summarize it any other way. Dr. Warren Chapin is a pathologist who regularly conducts autopsies on executed prisoners at state prisons. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, that's a cool character.
That's a great hook. Yeah.
He has a theory that fear is the result of a creature that inhabits all of us. This is where the science gets wonky. His theory is that the creature is suppressed by our ability to scream when fear strikes us. He gets the chance to prove his theories when he meets Ollie and Martha Higgins, who own and operate a second-run movie theater. Martha is deaf, a deaf-mute, and if she is unable to scream, extreme fear should make the creature, which Chapin has called the Tingler, come to life and grow. So using LSD to induce nightmares, he begins his experiments. There's a lot going on in this movie.
There is.
And I had heard of this movie for a long time. I know it's a William Castle movie. We didn't go into the fact that William Castle is the producer, director, that also was the gimmick meister for coming up with gimmicks to sell movies. In this
practical
case,
gimmicks, let's say. It's practical gimmicks. So he wanted the theaters altered in ways that would help his movies be scarier.
Right, and get people talking about them.
Yeah.
And in the case of this, there were a couple of things he did, including wiring seats to vibrate and, you know, mimic being, you know, electrocuted or the tinglers.
It was called Percepto.
Percepto.
With an exclamation point at the end. And yes, not every seat. Certain seats in the theaters were wired to vibrate on signals from the projectionist at certain moments in the movie, which is a pretty cool idea, I have to admit. I kind of like it. Because his gimmick for 13 Ghosts was like skeletons fly over the audience. Wasn't that something like that?
For 13 Ghosts, it was filmed in Illusion-O.
Illusion-O.
And each patron received a handheld ghost viewer remover. And during certain segments of the film, a person could see the ghost by looking through red cellophane or hide them by looking through blue.
So he used the 3D technology at the time.
Well, it says it's not 3D as some reported.
Okay.
I'm not really sure how he did it. It says the DVD release included red and blue glasses that were not 3D either.
Okay.
To replicate the effect. So I'm not really sure how he did it. But it has to be something.
Well, it's the same sort of thing. If you put something in the film that's the same color as the lens you have, it disappears. Because you don't see it the same way. You know, it's like that story I've shared before where that one show I was doing, we were doing a reader's theater, and I thought I would be so cool. And so to be different, I highlighted my whole script in blue rather than yellow because I thought I would be so Mr. Cool and be different than everybody else. We get to the theater and we start the show and everything goes to blue lights. So now I have no highlighter at all. Nothing is highlighted because the blue goes away under a blue light. So, yeah, so he's probably got red and he's shooting whatever the ghost is in red and you can, oh, look, oh, no, ooh, there it is.
Yeah, because it's a black and white film. You wouldn't see
it. Yeah, and there was one where he did it with the insurance thing. Whoever survives this movie, or you have to, in order to watch this movie, you got to sign an insurance claim of death or something.
Yeah, I have all of these.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to read them all, but I was going to maybe read a few of them when we do trivia.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, yes, he did. One of the things he had was an insurance policy that you could buy in case you were scared to death.
Scared to death, yeah. Your family would be able to survive after you.
So, yes, William Castle was not only a director and producer, he was a salesman.
Salesman, yeah,
so
definitely.
To speak. He is selling these movies with gimmicks.
Yes. Yeah. And hence the title of this, which is probably one of the weakest things about it, is the title. And the fact...
The Tingler? Oh, I agree.
And the fact that a scientist would come up with the name, Tingler, sounds perfect for my parasite that lives inside us.
And I admit, that's one of the reasons probably that I have not ever seen this movie, is because of the title alone.
It seems schlocky. It seems cheesy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree with you.
Yeah. William Castle, a little background, he was orphaned at 11 and at 13 saw the production of Dracula starring Bela Lugosi and was entranced. He dropped out of high school at 15 years old to work in the theater. He eventually became a horror thriller director promoting his low budgets using gimmicks. So he got started in the theater.
I wonder if that's why he wanted involvement. You know, because of theater. Theater is very dependent upon the audience to determine the performance. And I wonder trying to use some gimmicks that may have worked in theater.
He brought stuff out into the audience a lot. Yeah. Like you said, skeletons flying over people's heads and
seats vibrating seats. Under you. Yeah. Okay.
Interesting. The writer of The Tingler is a guy named Rob White, who is very familiar to Castle because he was a frequent Castle collaborator, and he wrote some of these things with those gimmicks in mind.
Of course.
So they kind of were partners at this. What else do I have? Well, he actually introduces this movie. He comes out like Alfred Hitchcock and talks to the audience.
Yep.
Because I noticed that it looked like he was about to laugh when he mentioned the relief, the screaming to relieve the tingling sensation.
Yeah, scream as loud as you can. Yeah.
He looked like he was about to laugh to me when he said that.
And it reminded me, I didn't put it in keys, but it just reminded me of, what did we do recently that was Italian, the four stories?
Black Sabbath.
And didn't that start with
last season?
With a curtain announced?
Boris Karloff,
yeah. Yes. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, sure. All did. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The only difference is that was in color and it was an anthology. This is not an anthology.
Right. But I just meant it started with a curtain speech. Kind of a la Alfred Hitchcocky sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, as far as other background, I really don't have any other background. I mentioned those movies, those other movies he's done. Do you have scenes you want to talk about from this movie?
I had just a little bit of background or trivia or whatever.
Oh, sure.
The adding the Percepto sort of thing literally doubled the budget, more than doubled it. The original budget was $400,000 with Percepto and having to outfit all of these theaters with these little buzzers and everything else. The final budget was over $1 million. So
I was going to say, how realistic is that to do that in theaters across America?
Now, it would probably be a little difficult. Back then, maybe, because it would probably come with the promotional items. So, you know, you would send it out when you send out the posters and send out the early trailer reels and all that and say, hey, you need to stick these under your seats. And I'm sure people didn't do it, you know.
Well, and it wouldn't be wireless. So where would you put the wires?
Well, you'd run them under the seats or wherever, I would assume.
Good Lord.
The other thing.
People would be stepping on them, tripping
and,
on them.
And, you know, to be precise, this is not actually electrical shock. It is a vibrator, essentially, you know. But
they have to trigger it somehow.
Correct. They trigger it from the booth is what I read. Also, in some theaters, they hired women to scream and then stop the whole movie and have that woman carried out in a stretcher. He said he predominantly did that, of course, in the Los Angeles and California area, probably because it's easier for him to, you know, send somebody to do that.
Stage it.
But that was just an additional gimmick, was during that blackout near the end, the first one, a woman in the theater literally screams, they bring up the house lights, they stop the movie, stretcher comes out and gets her, takes her away, and then you can finish the movie kind of thing. I also have that it was shot in 12 days.
Well, he was like Corman. He was very efficient.
Shot in 12 days and released 2 months after it was completed, after principal photography. So, I mean, it was one and done. In, out, go, boom.
and obviously the gimmick stuff must have already been thought out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because they can't just pull that out of their ass in 2 months.
Well, no, they had to have the gimmick in mind because the whole last part of this movie is tailored to the gimmick.
Well, and it's written in there.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah, I mean, it's all written for that, which is the weakest part of it, I think.
Honestly, I do like some of the stuff where there's blackouts and just voices.
I do like that. It just seems weird because he's talking directly to people. He's breaking the fourth wall kind of thing, which is weird.
Right. It is very weird. And the fact that the monster gets loose in a theater and then there's a blackout, so there's no light in the theater that you're sitting in.
See, like I love that concept.
And that's when they're buzzing people.
Oh, yeah.
You know it's when they're buzzing people.
The only other thing I have background-wise was the other gimmick in the movie, which I actually really liked and really shocked me, was the, and it's a good, I guess it's a good segue to scenes, as well as the red. Okay. The fact that you have the characters
all of a sudden being there's haunted. A scene in color.
Yeah, and there's not a scene in color, there's just color elements in the scene. Well, first of all, it's a sink, and the running faucet is blood running out of the faucet, and it's red. Everything else is in black and white. And then she looks at the bathtub, and the bathtub has blood all in it, and a big hand comes out of it, like that picture behind you. And that really got me. I thought that was a cool gimmick. That was really neat. It was very inventive. It was very different. Really liked it. Doing some research on it, found out just like, I guess, and this is a huge key reveal too, but just like Wizard of Oz. Everybody always talks about the scene in Wizard of Oz where, you know, Dorothy's holding Toto and she opens up the door and suddenly you see all the color and she walks out into it and she's in color now and everything else. And I've always thought, oh, wow, what a cool matte shot. And that's really interesting and everything else. But no, turns out doing research that was actually a color shot. So when you see the black and white door and black and white Dorothy walk up and open the door, that's a color that they've made gray. They didn't change it in the filtering. They didn't do anything. They actually had an actress in a black and white costume with black and white makeup and everything else. And then Dorothy is, because it's the way it's shot, Dorothy walks in and she's in color. This is the same way. She is made, the actress is made up in black and white, and that whole scene is in black and white and grays.
I thought I read somewhere where they like painted the frames or something.
Nope.
No?
It is a color scene that has been made to look like a... That's why it looks...
Okay.
If you go back, because I went back, after I read this, I went back and watched the scene a couple more times. It looks grainier. It looks weirder.
It looks weird around the edges of the fingers. Like, it looked blurry, and I thought, what have they done?
Well, even around the edge of her face, like when she first is looking in the bathroom and everything else, it's because of this effect that they're using. They suddenly switch to color film stock.
Interesting.
It was very interesting. I thought that was, you wouldn't think you would go to that amount of prep for a schlocky little B-movie. You know what I mean?
No.
Kind of thing. So I thought that was very, very interesting.
Yeah.
And the fact you just shocked me because that went to red and then it went back to black and white.
Oh, yeah.
Scenes? We like that scene, right? Did you like that scene?
My favorite scene in this movie is the scene where Vincent Price is tripping on acid. I never thought I would see Vincent Price on LSD.
I didn't either.
I have not really seen many movies where people are on LSD, and in my notes it just says Vincent be tripping.
I've got Vincent be tripping, then later on with her part I've got she be tripping too, and found out this was the first reference to LSD in a major motion picture.
Right. Yep. I saw that as well, and I was like, okay, I don't know when Reefer Madness came out, but they acted like people were tripping in that movie, and it was just marijuana.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah,
this was the first reference to LSD in film history, which I thought was interesting. Yeah.
But I love that scene. I love when he's like, the walls are getting closer.
And they're not. That's what I loved about it. I mean, you know, because I've heard that when people do hallucinogens,
yeah, I've heard
that they see things, you know, that right there. I loved him opening the window and saying, I can't get out. They're locked. They're locked.
Yeah. He's really not overacting.
No.
Well, I mean, I guess he is, in the fact that I've never seen somebody have a bad trip, so to speak. But he is talking funny stuff as far as being in another dimension, so to speak.
Well, but that goes to say Vincent Price is great in this entire movie.
This is
a really strong example of how good an actor he can be. To be as realistic and carry a scene where he's trying to name a parasite the Tingler, and we actually believe him or believe he believes it, that's great. It's good. He's very strong in this entire thing.
I think so too. I have some notes, but they may be in with casting. But yeah, I mean, because we've covered quite a few of Vincent Price's.
My other scenes. Another one of my scenes would be the fake out scene, the scene where he kills her and does the X-rays and everything. I thought, my God, now we are doing an Alfred Hitchcock movie. Kind of thing. And then it turns out that it was Blanks and he just, made her faint or fright to death or fright to faint.
It's very effective and very scary, or would have been to me as a child. But in retrospect, it's like, how the hell did he do all that? There's no way he could have done all that and been in all those different places.
Oh, wait. I think we're
throwing that
axe. I think we're talking about two different ones. I was talking about the Vincent Price shooting his wife.
Okay.
Scare. Which to me acted like a murder mystery kind of thing. We suddenly have Double Indemnity kind of feel to it.
Or Dial in for Murder,
kind of thing. And you're talking about where the other husband...
I'm talking about where the theater owner...
scares his wife to death, literally.
Right, and we don't know it's him at first, but like this corpse sits up in the bed and
starts chasing her. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And then at one point she runs into a room and a closet door or something opens and a hand comes out and throws an axe.
Yep.
And it sticks in the table. I mean, all of that stuff was very effective to me and would have scared the crap out of me as a kid.
Yes. Agreed.
In retrospect, I was like, how did he do all that? There's no way he could have done and been in those two different places and in that mat. And in that bed, she just happens to walk over to the bed and it's got, like, obviously something lying under a blanket on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I still like that scene. So, I mean, I'm bringing it up because it stuck out to me.
Me too. I thought it was scary. Yeah. I thought it was cool. Yeah. In retrospect, you think back and go, wait, how could... Was he throwing the axe while he's wearing the rubber mask? I don't understand. Mm-hmm. And he was so realistic as the nice guy husband that him turning out to be the murderer was kind of a jump for me. You know, I was kind of like, really? He's that guy?
It's not as much of a jump as him hanging around waiting for Vincent Price to take him to jail. I mean, he kept just kind of following Vincent and helping him solve the theater problem and all this shit. And I'm like, dude, you killed your wife and he's going to take you to jail and you're just hanging out.
Yeah. And oh, by the way, you are going to be charged for murder. I can't help that. And you're like,
but help me solve this problem with your theater first and then I'll take you to jail. I'm like, what?
Yeah, that was kind of weird and different. Well, that goes along that goes along with, and I brought my wife here. Okay, well, you don't mind. I have to do an autopsy because you just sit over here while I examine your wife.
And also the fact that it's just a spontaneous autopsy that he's ready to prepare.
Well, he's good at it. He does it every day.
So. Oh, my God. And I mean, if we're going to talk about scenes that we don't like, the first scene with Warren, David, and Lucy, I've got the dialogue between them is awful. Actually, the dialogue in all of this movie is terrible.
I don't mind I don't mind it that much. I thought it was very
stilted and
very Noel Coward-y theater. You know what I mean? It felt like a play, almost like an early play. Yeah, and very stilted. So I would, I go back on my retraction. I agree with you. I think that sequence was stilted. And David's character in general is weird as far as he's so easily distracted into, and what about this experiment? And we could do this and we could do, sorry, honey, I'll go with you. But wait, I have this idea that maybe we could, So there's that. I think some of that has to do with casting, though, right? Because wasn't he cast for some weird reason? He was cast...
Vincent?
No, the David character, the son-in-law.
He's Dobie Gillis's brother.
But I think...
But he's actually a more prolific actor than the guy that played Dobie Gillis.
But I thought he was he was somehow related or having a relationship with like one of the actresses.
Really? I don't remember reading that.
I don't know. I've checked my notes and see, but I thought so. Carry on.
His name is Daryl Hickman. You're talking about David, the young guy.
The young guy, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't have that note.
I think I remember reading something like that, that the Castle cast him because he had...
Well, we can, if you don't have any more scenes, we could move on to casting.
Sure.
First of all, the most... the big gap for this movie is Vincent Price. I mean, Vincent Price by that time had established himself as a horror movie actor.
Yeah.
I just found a note that says, I keep telling myself that Vincent Price has done some good movies, but four of the five we've covered pretty much sucked. And the five that we have done with him, including this one, are The Fly, The Raven, both Fibes movies, mm-hmm. and The Last Man on Earth.
Yep.
I mean, The Fly's not bad.
No.
No, the original Fly with him in it is not bad. So, oh, you know what? We also did House of Wax. I don't have that in there. So this is the sixth movie we've done of his.
Okay.
Wow. That's a lot of Vincent Price. But you know what? He was definitely a horror movie icon.
He was a horror icon, yep.
Yes. But so I don't have any other notes on him because we pretty much know Vincent Price. Do you have anything to say about him?
Other than I like him in this.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's...
I thought he was okay in it, yeah.
Yeah, I think he's good in this particular film.
And it's one, I would say that if you listed a Vincent Price resume, this would come up in the top 10, probably.
Oh, easily.
Because of just notoriety.
Well, yeah. And I would push it. I would push it more than House of Wax, even as to showing his acting range. And how good he can be.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's nicely compassionate as the coroner doctor at the beginning. And then he gets jealous. And then he has an acid trip. And then he becomes scared, you know, and all that.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's very mature going on in this.
Oh, yeah.
Because it starts off with him seeing his wife being dropped off by one of her hookups.
Mm-hmm.
And she's clearly sleeping around on him. And clearly, young Lucy knows this because they talk about
it. Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, this is kind of an adult movie for the time. And then there's an LSD trip. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, there's some pretty deep subject matter going on.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it got away with so much. If he got away with so much just because they thought it was going to be schlock. And maybe the censor guys didn't even read the script or anything.
Maybe so.
You know?
Maybe so. Because
oh, he's doing doing one of those drive-in pitches. Let him do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Reefer Madness, whenever it came out, I want to say in the 40s or 50s, mm-hmm. was kind of banned for a while because it was thought too dangerous or whatever.
Yeah, it could scare children.
There was some kind of history going on with that movie as well.
Reefer Madness actually came out in 1936.
Yeah, it was pretty early, yeah. I remember, and it kind of got pulled for a while, mm-hmm. because of it being, you know,
too graphic, like,
scary or too dangerous. Yeah, something.
It could corrupt the youth of America.
That as well.
Just like our podcast. No.
Yeah. Oh, but back to casting.
Yes.
Judith Evelyn,
yes.
Played Martha Ryerson Higgins, the deaf mute, mm-hmm. in this.
Yep.
She got second billing. Do you know where else we saw her in where she was a deaf mute?
I don't know. A silent movie?
Or she wasn't a deaf mute, but she doesn't say anything.
A silent movie? No, I don't know.
No, she was Miss Lonely Hearts in Rear Window, the Alfred Hitchcock movie.
Okay. All right.
The one that, you remember, you know, Jimmy Stewart's making up all these stories about people he's looking,
yep.
at through a telescope.
Telling the story.
And other, yeah. She was also in Giant. So she's done some big movies.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, it wasn't the first time she had worked with Vincent Price. They had both starred on stage together in 1941 in a production of Angel Street.
Oh, good movie. I mean, good play.
Well, it's based on, it says, they starred on stage together in 1941 during the Broadway performance of Angel Street based on Patrick Hamilton's play Gaslight. Well, if it's based on that play, why is it a play?
Well, because it was a remake of it.
Yeah. Daryl Hickman, as you mentioned before, played David Morris.
Yep.
His brother is Dwayne Hickman and got famous around that same time as Dobie Gillis, a television show starring Bob Denver as well, the guy that played Gilligan.
I have in my notes, he met a lady named Pamela Lincoln. who was the daughter, and they were were dating when this movie was shot, and they ended up getting married and not divorced until 1982.
Okay, and you're saying that's why she was cast in this?
Correct. Yeah.
That's from what you were saying earlier.
Yeah. Yeah, that.
Yeah, I did not have that.
That name. Castle liked both of them together because they were dating anyway, and they were both actors. Yada yada. So worked.
Just be in my movie. That's funny.
Oh, okay. And I have the answer really quick. I just looked it up. Patrick Hamilton wrote Gaslight originally, which was later changed into Angel Street in theater.
Okay. Yeah.
So. It's the same play.
They changed the title, correct, but then they went back to that title for the movie.
Correct.
Yep. Okay, because the movie has Ingrid Bergman in it, right? Mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
And it was like Angela Lansbury's screen debut.
Yes.
Too. I have way too much trivia in my head. This is why I get confused.
Well, and the other note I have about Daryl Hickman is he's still alive.
I read that, yep. And I went on IMDb and looked at his resume, since they said he worked more than his brother, the Dobie Gillis guy that got famous. Yeah. And he has worked steadily for like decades. I mean, he has a long list of things he's been in.
IMDb currently lists him with over 149 acting roles.
Right. Yep. And a lot of it's television, I'm sure. But
yeah.
It's still a very prolific career for this man as far as an actor.
Oh, yeah.
So that was Daryl Hickman. Patricia Cutts plays Isabel Stevens Chapin, the philandering, I guess you would say, wife.
Harlot.
Can you?
Trollop.
Is philandering a male word or is that a female?
No, I think it can be bigender, yes.
Okay, because yes. She is screwing around on him. I don't have anything really for her except TV credit. She does not have that much.
No.
And then, like you said, Pamela Lincoln played Lucy. Her credits are very sparse, too. However, I did notice she was the secretary in the movie Tootsie.
Oh.
From 1982.
Okay.
I thought that was kind of fun. And then lastly, we should note that William Castle is also in this movie playing himself. He is uncredited as the guy that introduces the film.
Yeah, the narrator or whatever. Yeah.
And says that if you start feeling the tingler in yourself, scream and it will go away.
And it will go away immediately, yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what I have for casting as far as awards. There's only a posthumous one for William Castle and a DVD collection that came out in 2010. No other awards for this film, and it is not on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list.
No, and probably I can agree with that. I don't think it...
Yeah, me too.
The only other thing I've got in my notes is I say, I love the fact that they use the term Rankin rays rather than X-rays. Because this was before X-rays were really established sort of thing.
Oh, so, I didn't realize that. So, I didn't know the origin of the process.
Rankin rays, yep. Yeah. Want to move on to keys then?
Well, I was going to look and see if I had any other trivia.
Yeah. People were frightened out of their minds. No.
Vincent Price be tripping. There's some keys. Oh, trivia. Well, I have some more gimmicks. Everything ended in an O. I think we mentioned Percepto and Illusiono for House of Haunted Hill.
Yeah.
It was called Emergo, and it was a skeleton with red lighted eye sockets attached to a wire that floated over the audience in the final moments of some showings of the film to parallel the action of a skeleton on screen coming out of a vat of acid.
Okay.
I do remember that one, that particular gimmick. Homicidal, which gets the highest rating on Rotten Tomatoes than any other William Castle movie. It's a movie called Homicidal, and it stars Joan Crawford.
Hmm.
There was a fright break with a timer overlaid on the film's climax. As the heroine approaches a house harboring a sadistic killer, the audience had 45 seconds to leave and get a full refund if they were too frightened to see the remainder of this film. In an early showing, patrons simply sat through the movie a second time and left at the break to get their money back. To prevent this in the future, Castle had different colored tickets printed for each showing. About 1% of patrons still demanded refunds.
Did you read the gimmick for Sardonicus?
I don't have it.
Mr. Sardonicus, according to my notes, they had a punishment pole.
Yes.
They were given a card that glows in the dark. And at one point in the movie, they can vote thumbs up or thumbs down for the punishment. I'm assuming it never changed the ending, but they could vote.
It was just a gag.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I'm glad we covered this movie today, because there is a very huge place in the history of horror movies for William Castle.
Of course.
And even though all of his movies weren't great, most of his movies weren't great.
Most.
He is definitely someone that we should talk about. There's another one called Straitjacket that also has Joan Crawford in it.
Okay.
I think she's in both of those. And in Straitjacket, advised by financial backers to eliminate the gimmicks, Castle hired Joan Crawford to star and sent her on a promotional tour to select theaters. So that's what he did instead of a gimmick with that one. I Saw What You Did was promoted with giant plastic telephones.
Mm. Yeah, I don't see that so much as a gimmick as promotion, you know.
Right, right. So, and apparently it probably evolved into that because of expense, would be my guess.
And we would never review that for this show, just because it doesn't fall into either of our genres.
Right.
But I do like that movie a lot. I'm going to have to watch it again.
Straitjacket?
No, I Saw What You Did. That's such a great movie.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
All right, yeah, that's pretty much... You know what? I had some other trivia. John Waters is a big fan.
Oh, he did Smell-O-Vision or whatever.
He did. And I can't seem to find... Oh, among his admirers is filmmaker John Waters, who wrote, "William Castle was my idol. His films made me want to make films. He is a god."
Well, I wouldn't proclaim him that highly, but he definitely led to Waters doing a lot of the gimmicks he did, of course.
He did. I also have that he is Robert Zemeckis' favorite filmmaker. Zemeckis co-founded Dark Castle Entertainment, which was intended to remake Castle films. And that's why we have remakes of The House on Haunted Hill and 13 Ghosts. Both of those have been remade, and that is a Robert Zemeckis production company. I had no idea.
I remember the remake of 13 Ghosts is actually scary. It's weird, but it's scary.
Well, I always thought that if we ever covered those movies, we would do a double feature of the old and the new.
Oh, that'd be fun. That'd be fun to do 13 Ghosts that way, because it's. I've even seen recently petitions or people asking, do a limited series of 13 Ghosts, and each episode tells one of the ghosts' stories. Kind of Haunting Hill-ish, you know.
I get the Haunting of Hill House and House on Haunted Hill confused all the time. I say them the wrong way. But the House on Haunted Hill, I think, gets higher rated than 13 Ghosts, but I can't remember.
Yeah, I would think so.
I mean, it was definitely more well-known.
Yeah.
13 Ghosts I saw as a child on, like, Shock Theater, and it scared me.
Yeah, I remember seeing 13 Ghosts as a kid, and the black and white was scary, but the new remake is really scary. I mean, because it's gorier, it's more horrific, yeah.
Well, if I haven't paired them up on the list, I will do that.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
I think I did already, though, maybe.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
And that's probably a good segue, because I don't have many keys, and that technically is a key, because those sequels were keys.
Oh, yeah.
Because Zemeckis made them based upon these original movies.
Of course, they were keys. I have Hitchcock, of course, from the very opening. That is such a Hitchcock opening. And Castle later on in some of his teasers and trailers was the same way. He did like the trailers with him sitting in the director's chair and then turning around and talking to the audience about, my next movie is going to have, you know, blah, blah, blah. Very Hitchcock to me.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I have Alfred Hitchcock as a key as well. I lifted this from IMDb, but Hitchcock has said that he decided to make Psycho after noting the financial success of these 50s B-movies by Castle and Roger Corman.
That makes sense.
So, and that, you know, he did go back to low budget and black and white and made a classic.
Yeah, keys going back and forth. Look at that noise. Mm-hmm. I've got classic keys. Of course, I've got Jekyll and Hyde. This is a really kind of Jekyll and Hyde feel with the professor trying his own experiment kind of thing. It doesn't have the results of Jekyll and Hyde, but it's that same kind of thing. And then I've got The Fly, not just the reference, because there's some line where he says, my arm felt like it was in a hydraulic press. And I went, just like in The Fly.
Like in The Fly. That's hilarious.
But he also, again, a scientist who experiments on himself. He has his own lab in his house, and he's estranged from his wife because of it. All of this kind of stuff. So very Fly influenced, too.
Totally agree. You may have a better example than me, but I came up with The Shining as far as the blood reference.
Yeah.
What's another one where blood is coming out of faucets? Or in The Shining, it's coming out of an elevator.
Well, the most recent I can think of is It. The remake of It has...
You know, you're right. There is a good scene with
that whole bathroom freaking explodes in blood. So, yeah.
Yeah, there's that. So that may be better than The Shining. Now that
but both of them are good references to the effectiveness of a shot with blood that is really impactful in the story. It means a lot. Yeah, so I would agree with both of those. I think both of those are good. I've got... I'll save that
Keep
one.
Going to
I'll save that one for later. Oh, I have a trivia thing. It says the actual design of the Tingler was inspired by a rubber worm that special effects artist Jack Dussick had just laying around, and Castle saw it and had him modify it to become the Tingler. So that's kind of a trivia thing.
Since you mentioned that creature, we really didn't talk about it a lot, but there is like a monster creature in this movie that literally comes, is removed from somebody. And I have Alien because basically there's a monster inside you that is coming out.
Yep.
It just happens to look like a giant centipede with big pinchers on the end. It looks like a Star Trek bug.
Well, that's exactly one of my key I was laughing about was Wrath of Khan. It looks like the earworm in Wrath of Khan.
Oh, okay.
Because it has the only indigenous species to Seti Alpha 5. It's the clicker thing. They're young. Burrow in the ear. Anyway, you mentioned the creature. A creature actually scaring people in a movie theater is... another movie we already covered, which was Blob. The Blob. Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot. That's actually a very good case because it's centralized around a scene in a movie theater. You mentioned Wizard of Oz.
Yep.
So I'll put that in there. I don't know that I really have that much else.
Well, I've got Frankenstein. Frankenstein also starts with a fourth wall break at the very beginning.
You know, you're absolutely right. And I want to say something else we saw recently did too.
Well, we talked about Black Sabbath from last season. It does. Starts with a fourth
wall.
It
does. That's not what I'm thinking about. The one I'm thinking about is in black and white. Was it The Mummy, maybe? I can't remember.
I don't think The Mummy does. Not the one that...
Or Dracula?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Dracula might. Now that I think about it, I can't remember, but Dracula might.
Well, Frankenstein's a good example for a key because we know for sure that it comes out in Thomas.
I've got...
Because it's Dr. Pretorius, the same guy.
Mm-hmm. I've got a... Castle has said the deaf mute was inspired by a character in Spiral Staircase. I haven't watched Spiral Staircase, so I couldn't comment on that, but I love
from IMDb. I haven't seen that movie since I was a kid, but I loved it. It's a good thriller.
I thought it was a thriller, yeah. It was like a murder mystery thriller sort of thing.
But you just gave me another key by mentioning it. By mentioning the deaf mute, she reminded me a lot of the Agnes Moorehead character in the Twilight Zone episode.
Xanthi Misfits, yes. Yeah, definitely.
Is that it called the Xanthi
Misfits?
That's
actually an Outer Limits episode, isn't it? Xanthi Misfits is Outer Limits. You're talking about the episode of Twilight Zone where she has no dialogue at all. She's the mute all the way
through. Right, and there's she's...
There's a little robot terrorizing her because there's a UFO upstairs in her attic. Yeah, what was the name of that one? That was a good one. That was a good episode of Twilight Zone.
That's the one where she's the deaf mute, right?
Yes,
I'm pretty sure. Okay. No. And this woman reminded me of Agnes Moorehead, actually.
Yeah, in the look and the frown and everything. Mm-hmm. I also thought I wanted to go back and look and research and see, because she's not doing ASL. I don't know what she's doing. I think they're making this up, all these little
creatures. I was wondering that. I did not have any way of knowing because I don't know ASL. But I was like, is that real?
But it didn't look like ASL, you know. So I don't think it was. I think they were just making sign language.
That's not very politically correct.
Not now. No, that probably wouldn't work. And I have one that I'm surprised you didn't get that I wrote down that said Tim will love this. I think this is a good key for body horror, like Cronenberg and Carpenter and everything else. I mean, they're pulling this thing out of her. It ends up latching onto his arm. It's this whole fear of something inside you is going to come out and erupt kind of thing. So very body horror kind of key.
Body horror / Cronenberg. No, I totally get where you're going with it, but it's also so wonky. I'm like, how would we not know that this thing lives on our spine?
Well, but remember, at this time, radon, I mean, there weren't even x-rays. They were called radon rays, and they were, you know, they weren't really used a lot. So people didn't see inside the body a lot unless you did autopsies or stuff like that. So the thought of us having a parasite inside us that we didn't know about that only emerged when we are engorged.
Well, is it microscopic and grows?
Well, evidently, yeah. His theory, I think, in that one scene, he was saying that it's small, and then as fear increases, it grows. So it feeds off of fear kind of thing, which is kind of like a Star Trek key, because Roddenberry was kind of obsessed with that whole entities that feed off emotion thing. So that might be a Star Trek reference, too.
But, well, we had Star Trek Rathcon already. Yeah. But, yeah, well, obviously, it's implausible.
Yeah, no, don't buy the science in it. No, and I don't buy the ending of this movie at all. I think in my notes, it actually says, so, he really didn't have an ending for this at all, did he?
I can't even remember how it ended. How did it end?
It ends with, like, the double blackouts of everyone stay calm, stay in your seats, it's okay, blah, blah, blah. And then we come back and he goes looking for the creature, but it gets away. And then it goes to a blackout again and people scream. And it's like, really?
And that's how it ends?
That's how you ended this? With this little weird kind of, it's escaped and don't be afraid. If the only way to prevent it is to scream. So, yeah, there's that.
I thought it was funny in the beginning when he was telling people to scream, I think it's when it first starts and it shows the floating heads screaming.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That was great.
He's going, scream, scream if you want to live. Yeah, sort of thing.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I don't guess I have anything else. How would you sum this?
I would sum this up again. David. I think that we both enjoy it for different reasons. Mm-hmm. I obviously like it a little bit more than you, as far as because I kind of appreciate the whole pastiche shtick of it kind of thing. And I really like Price in it. He's not that older Price, like Fibes, where he's like just phoning it in kind of feel. But he's not trying to be melodramatic like House of Wax. He's very realistic here. It's a lot of theater chops. So I liked that part of it. We both agreed it probably shouldn't be on the 100 movies you should watch, or 1001, but it's still a fun thing to watch for the castle-isms in it. And his whole, you can't talk about 50s and 60s horror movies or drive-in movies or B-movies even without talking about him, the same way you can't later on talk about Corman. You know, they were obviously keys to each other. And
it's a good way to start off Halloween month, because this is our October 2nd episode, and I wanted to have spookier stuff for Halloween. This is not necessarily scary, but I think William Castle ranks highly in the horror world.
Of course.
As far as Halloween goes.
And our October will be full of horror, so it'll be fun and good.
And I tried to pick them.
And we want to thank all of you guys out there for listening to us ramble about this. Love to hear what you guys think. Did you like it? Did you dislike it? When was the first time you saw it? Have you ever seen it before? That sort of thing. We'd love for you, again, do your typical thing. If you ring the bell down there or subscribe, you'll get updates on all of our new episodes when they drop. We try to drop them every Monday and hope they're out and you can watch them on your podcast platform of choice. If you like us, we also would love to support the show. We would always appreciate some support. We do have a Patreon, and Patreon members get special podcasts. We have one called The Dilithium Chamber, where we're talking about the original series of Star Trek, and X-Files Declassified, where we examine each episode of The X-Files. So we would love to have you guys join us there for as little as, you know,
join us.
Cup of coffee a month. You could, you know, help us and keep the show going.
Various subscription plans.
Yes, you can do that. And we also have, you know, some coming attraction stuff coming to get you. And Tim has a Shudder show, which is pretty cool with all of his Shudderations and all that. And we would love to see you guys next week when we delve even more into scary.
What are we doing?
It's something too scary, I'll bet. It's Halloween, baby. It's October.
It's a little further into the future than this one.
Oh, good. All right. Yeah. Until then, Tim, I guess I'll see you next week.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to Johnny Has the Keys. You can learn more about us at our website, johnnyhasthekeys.com, and our Facebook page. Avoid missing shows by subscribing on iTunes and Google Play, and please, please like, rate, and review us. We're doing this for genre geeks like ourselves, and we can't continue without your support. See you next show, and don't lose your keys.